With less than 2 months to go in the Vancouver municipal elections, this is the Canby Report mayoral interview series. We are delighted to be sitting down today with Kennedy Stewart, who is running as an independent for the mayor's office in the city of Vancouver. Thank you so much for sitting down with us, Kennedy.
Great. Really happy to be here in the Nerve Center.
You know, we're joined, as always, by Patrick Meehan and Ian Bushfield.
Thank you.
Thanks.
What you're going to hear now is a shortened version of the full interview we recorded with Kennedy. If you want to listen to our full interview running about an hour, it'll be on our Patreon at patreon.com/CanbyReport. For people who don't know who you are, let's maybe go into a bit of your background. You were born in Halifax and then decided to come out to Vancouver later.
Yeah, I mean, my early life is actually formative, like for everybody, but I was born in Halifax, but I grew up in the Annapolis Valley. And in the late 70s, I was kind of a middle-class kid, but in the late 70s, my dad lost his job and we went bankrupt. And we lost everything, including our home. And so I actually lived in rural poverty for a good 5 years. And that really set kind of who I am now. And from that experience, I moved out to Vancouver in the late 1980s as a musician. So how I got out here was playing my bass and singing and made it out to Vancouver. I only went to Halifax kind of once a year. And so living in a big city was a big adjustment. And I just fell in love with the place. Like everything I've got in my life is from Vancouver, essentially. But those early formative years of going through bankruptcy and losing a home and seeing the impacts that it had on my family, which, you know, some family members never really recovered from that, I think really sets my priorities as a person and, you know, what I care about and what I'd like to try to do as mayor.
So you said that you came out here as a musician. Now, we understand you were a bass player.
That's right, yeah.
For a band called State of Mind.
That's right, yep. We formed in 1989, and I did, you know, I read an ad in the Georgia Strait or something and went and auditioned, and we eventually went on to win Demolition Derby, which is the very first kind of Seafox contest.
The Seeds.
Yeah. The Seeds 5, yeah, the very first one of those.
Oh, wow.
And then I played the Commodore 50 times, the Town Pump, that was here.
You know, no big deal. I played the Commodore.
Yeah, probably one of the biggest shows we played there was with Barney Bentall, which I think sold out for a couple nights in a row. And then Much Music and videos and recording in the Vancouver studios on Little Mountain. So that was a really a formative part of my life. But then I always get teased. Stephen Quinn always teases me about this, is that I found rock and roll boring and then I went into academia.
Because you went and did a master's in poli-sci at SFU and then studied government at London School of Economics. What is it that attracted you to studying politics, essentially, in academic terms?
Yeah, so it's funny because I was talking to folks about Labor Day, and what's important to me about Labor Day is the first union job I ever had was at the city of Vancouver. I was hired in there in the planning department for a year, just a short-term contract, but it was the first time I'd ever worked in a unionized environment. And so two things happened to me there, kind of galvanized my progressive view of the world. But I also fell in love with cities. I was tasked with writing up profiles for each of the neighborhoods based on Statistics Canada information. And then from that, I thought, wow, you know, how do cities work? Some work, some don't work. How do you make them better? And so then I applied for my master's at SFU to study Vancouver. So my master's thesis was every single municipal election since 1886, looking at how, you know, I had to go in the archives.
In Vancouver specifically?
Yeah, in Vancouver specifically.
What is it that drove you to want to get involved in electoral politics? Like, why did you go from an observer to a participant?
Yeah, the... you know, politics, of course, being a political scientist is something I was always interested in, and elections in particular. But I guess it was Jack Layton had just come on as federal leader in 2004 or 2003, and that was a very exciting thing. And one of my colleagues, David Black, one evening said to me, "Hey, you should think about running federally in Vancouver Centre." And I took him up on it. I fought a very tough nomination contest and won it to stand against Hetty Fry. And the polling in the last week had me ahead. And, you know, I thought, well, this is a chance to join. Who else was elected? Was Nathan Cullen and Peter Julian. They were both elected in that series of elections. But alas, the Liberals is the tried and true. A vote for the NDP is a vote for Stephen Harper. And then the Liberals shifted back to to the Liberals, or the Progressive vote shifted back to Liberals. So that was my first foray. Learned a lot, though. I mean, there's no better place in the world to campaign than Davie Street because everything starts after 10 o'clock. So, that was a great experience. And I found out I really, really enjoyed it. But, after the election was over, I had to get back to work and get my tenure at SFU.
You also had a bit of a run-in with the law earlier this year.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's a whole other side of being a member of Parliament. And I'm glad you brought that up because the day after I was elected, May 2nd, 2011, May 3rd, I was contacted by Ian Anderson's office, the president of Kinder Morgan, and I met with him four times over the subsequent year where he talked about this idea he had of building a pipeline, a brand new pipeline from Edmonton to Burnaby to ship bitumen to the coast and send it out by tankers. And I was probably one of the first people to hear about this because they hadn't applied to the National Energy Board and all the documents were confidential at that point. But I told Mr. Anderson that I not only did I think that he wasn't going to get his new pipeline built, that I thought, and this is objective. I didn't go in with an idea that I didn't support or oppose his project. I listened to what he had to say, but I didn't think it would fly in my community. But so once I had the details of the plan, I called every household in my riding, that's 40,000 households, and I had them vote using a phone voting thing. And 5,000 people voted and 75% said they didn't want it. So, I was a pretty new MP, but I thought, well, if my constituents don't want a project in our riding that is, a huge change to how they're going to live, then I should go off and oppose it. And I made the commitment to them that I would. I didn't actually think it would get all the way to the point where I'd be arrested with them, but that's what happened earlier this year.
It's just, I guess, blunt to say it, but you are another white man. And Vancouver has never had a woman or a person of color, mm-hmm. despite being one of the most diverse cities in Canada. Sean has made the point that she needs to be in this race, not just because she thinks she can win it, like everyone who's running, but because Vancouver could use a woman in power. And Ian Campbell has talked about the importance of having an Indigenous person sure. in leadership. Do you see that as an issue for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's always difficult when you have a single position that's being vied for. You can't split it up like in seats in a House of Commons or in a proportional representation system. So, I mean, that's for people to decide. For me, equity has been a huge part of what I've stood for. For example, my last private member's bill that wasn't successful, I tried to get incentives for more women to be recruited to the House of Commons by the parties. I split 23 Liberals off the backbenches to vote with me, but Trudeau's cabinet and the Conservatives voted against. Also within the NDP, I pushed for equity at the provincial and federal level. So I feel pretty comfortable with that. But with a single position, what can you do? I mean, so I think that on council, there's lots of room. And I think that's where electoral reform could come in, is that we could have a fairer process, either preferably proportional representation. And I guess we're having a big referendum on that. So we'll see how that turns out in Vancouver. But I do think it's up for, people to hang their signs out and then voters will decide.
Every campaign is going to try to identify, who their average voter is. There's a lot of votes to be had, but, you want to target your voters. How would you define or how would you describe your target voter?
Yeah, well, in the last federal election, 98,000 people voted for the federal NDP in Vancouver. That's a lot.
And so New Democrats.
Yeah, New Democrats. Okay. And that wasn't a particularly good election for us. So
it's true.
So if it goes back up to 130,000, 140,000 around that level, plus the success of the BC NDP, it's not just New Democrats. I talk with federal Liberals all the time, especially those who are opposed to the Kinder Morgan pipeline. There's a lot of room there on that side. Plus, Elizabeth May and I wrote a book together last year, so very close to Green voters as well. I would say that is probably the spectrum, although, people that like the work that I did on the toughening the criminal code against impaired driving may attract others as well. So, but mainly New Democrats would be my core.
Everyone's using the phrase, what is a housing crisis?
Yeah, for me, it's not so much about people not being able to buy homes on, the west side of Vancouver. It's more about people that make the median income or lower that can't afford to live here. And essentially a very... a non-splashy term that I would use is workforce housing. Essentially, where you're finding the pinch in this city is with the workforce, is that We talk, you know, I know the city currently measures things. Oh, well, you know, it's median income. It's 1/3 of median income. So it's affordable, but it's only affordable for people making over the median income. It's not affordable for people making under the median income. And that is the big problem in our debate here. So the measure we've been using is incorrect, but we also haven't been building that kind of housing. And the big, I agree with lots of folks to say that there's a lack of federal and provincial investment, and that has been a big problem. So if you look at cities around the world where they'll have 15, 20, 25% or more of their housing stock, and Hong Kong is like 70%, which has some kind of public investment in it, here it's 8%. It is really low. And if we don't, and our stock is deteriorating, right? So this kind of public housing widely wrote, I'm not talking about SROs in the downtown east side. I'm talking about places for workers to live.
So what are the major policies you want to implement? You've mentioned a couple, but what is the specific policies you want to implement?
Well, we're starting to roll up my platform next week. And so the first big thing we'll be talking about is housing, but there's lots of stuff to deal with in cities. So housing will all be about affordability. It'll my platform will address both the demand and supply side. A lot of it will be focused on speculation. I think that is a big concern of people here, and it's not just supply, it's not just demand, it's both, and so they always go together, and so you have to keep an eye on both of those factors. So that will come out, and it'll be very detailed. You'll get your numbers. I've had a team working on this now all summer, so you know it'll be probably the most detailed thing of our platform. But one of the things that's been left out of the conversation with this election is the downtown east side, and more widely the opioid crisis. I think that we need to do more to champion folks that are part of our community, that are our neighbors, and that are dying in droves. And you know, lots of hand wringing about it. But really, once you talk to the folks that work down there, and I've done academic work down there, and I've talked to frontline workers, and then academics, and we can come up with better solutions than what we have there. So that, but that, it's weird to say, but I think folks are so stressed out about their own housing that sometimes they can't extend, the care we need to have extended to those folks that are in real trouble. So I think this election is going to be dominated by folks saying my housing situation is really bad.
It's good that you talked on about the opioid crisis, because I think that is one of the things that does get sort of ignored a bit, like you said, in the housing talk. But one of the things we did was we talked to one of the lawyers from Pivot Legal Society last week. And I know that this has been in the news quite a bit, is with the opioid crisis, a lot of these overdose prevention sites are having police presence pretty mm-hmm. regularly up front of it. And there's a lot, big call for the city to try to curb that, to get the police to not sort of loiter outside of the buildings. What would you do about that as mayor?
Yeah, I mean, it does have to be a balance, right? That you do have to make sure that you're getting advice from both sides, front lines on both sides. So you're hearing from police, and I wouldn't say both sides. I would say all parts of that policy community need to be consulted. So I have, I've toured been in the safe injection site, or, the supervised injection site tons, because I used to take my classes through there. But I have gone to the unofficial sites, ones Sarah Blythe runs, and I do think that they have found ways forward there that have to be supported. I do hear complaints from that constituency about policing, but I haven't talked to the police yet about it. And I didn't think it was appropriate through an election to do that. So I will wait, I'll read the reports that they've put in, but I do think it's a conversation that has to be had, and that is a perfect thing for a mayor to do.
Circling back around to housing, I've listened to a couple of the interviews you've done or things you've talked about, and you talked about the number of measures that are being applied by the provincial and federal governments. And I guess we're seeing some potential slowdown in the market already, mm-hmm. but I think people are still feeling like it's a crisis. So this interview may actually come out just slightly after your policy announcements,
okay, sure.
or in the same realm, but are there immediate actions you're going to be taking, or will it be a more wait and see approach?
No, there's immediate actions. First of all, if you look at the demand side, there are already three major policies that have gone in place in a very short period of time. So one is the empty homes tax, of course, which is the city level, but also at the provincial level, we've had the school the extra school tax, and then we've had the speculation tax. And the speculation tax, Carol James is going to ramp that up again in January, I understand. So being a policy professor, I would say If you've brought in three brand new policies to deal with one aspect of housing, that is demand, and in particular speculation, you should probably see how that's working before you bring in anything else on that side of the spectrum. So I would say that there may be more we can do. Like maybe the empty homes tax is not sufficient. Perhaps we can increase that. And that is under specific jurisdiction of the province. But there's a lot we can do on the supply side, a lot. And in terms, especially when it comes to the affordable, the nonprofit housing side of things, is that to refocus council on making sure that we're doing everything we can with the property endowment fund and the lands that we have, not just the city, but also the school board is sitting on a ton of land that could also be, the population of young people kind of declines, then you can do other things with that land that could accommodate new schools with housing incorporated. And so this is done all over the world. So there's no reason why land has to sit fallow here. But we have to be entirely focused. And I don't like to quote John Baird, but he often said this in the House of Commons, focused like a laser on this. And it is... It is housing for folks that are making, the workforce housing, essentially median income or below.
So Vancouver has a rental replacement policy where if you bulldoze a rental mm-hmm. building, you have to replace those rental units. Burnaby does not.
Right.
You faced a lot of criticism during your run here for not speaking up during the dem evictions that were occurring in Burnaby, especially around Metrotown. Do you regret not speaking up earlier?
Well, I know a good smear campaign when I see one, and I really consider that what that was. So for the first 4 years of my career as a parliamentarian, I wasn't the MP for that area of the city. I was the MP for North Burnaby, where the main issue was Kinder Morgan. There was some issue with co-ops that were losing their agreements with the federal government, so I worked very hard to secure those, and we did get those secured. I only came into South Burnaby Metrotown area after the 2015 election and immediately started working on the housing issues there. So the Metrotown stuff that was happening was occurring before I was there as an MP. But immediately when I got there, what I started to do is basically I turned my office into a place for people that needed emergency services. So if you needed to use a phone or have something notarized or get ID, and then I would work with the MLAs to try to get people placements. I would actually visit the home. I would go to the buildings that people were in, the ones that were being raised, but also the ones that were just in terrible shape, because I used to live there. I used to live in, when I very first moved here from Nova Scotia, that's where I lived. And I was living in buildings in the 80s that were in terrible shape then. And so I took it upon myself to go and try to force landlords. And this is unusual for an MP to call a landlord and say, hey, clean up the garbage in that basement or I'm going to come after you. And which I did on a number of occasions. And in fact, the thing is with social media and that kind of thing, something gets out of control. And I know when I see Mike Klassen writing about me, I know like, okay, this is a smear campaign, right? This is, so if you talk to my constituents, which, I'm in Ottawa an awful lot, but I have great staff. I ask them, is anybody coming in to talk about this? And they'll say, no. I ran into Wanda Mulholland today, who is the former head of the Burnaby Homelessness Society. I mean, we supported that, ringing endorsements. And in fact, I have a stack of thank you letters for the work I've done on housing. So especially when it comes to co-ops, we've saved hundreds of co-op units in Burnaby South alone. And that is my exclusive federal jurisdiction. So what I learned from being a federal politician is exactly this lesson. I mean, people want me to come out and attack people in the media, but I know that doesn't do any good. It might make you feel better, but Burnaby has significantly changed their housing policy, right? And I think it's because of what I was able to do by not yelling at people and talking with them reasonably that we got changes.
Speaking of smear campaigns, are you paid for by a secret cabal of union leaders in hopes of getting a sweetheart deal during the 2019 bargaining year?
I love Hector Bremner, or apparently, I think like if you're going to say I'm attached to the unions, you're going to put it all over the internet, and that's a smear. I think great, go for it. Keep your secret money flowing through fake Facebook accounts and go for it. But one thing I would like to ask other candidates for mayor is if they've ever stood on a picket line in support of workers, because I've done it dozens of times. And I really think, you know, I'm proud of supporting working people that are unionized and have got collective agreements. And I think they do excellent work at the city. Unlike Ken Sim, who said he'll come in and run it like a business and try to break the unions, and then we'll get strikes, right? And so there is a balance you have to strike. You can't give away the store. But to attack unions is a wrong thing to do if you're trying to be mayor.
So one of our last sort of topics to bring up, one of them, is reconciliation indigenizing the city. As we've seen cities, you know, finding ways to do this. The city of Vancouver recently renamed some of its public squares after indigenous names. Mayor Lisa Helps in Victoria removed a statue of Johnny McDonald. What do you think that you would do or fight to do at the city to build reconciliation and to indigenize?
Yeah, I mean, I think those symbolic gestures, I'm not so sure about the Johnny McDonald. I thought there might be, the prophet in me says, well, maybe if we'd had a plaque there explaining the problem with what happened on, you know, that might have been a bit, you know, my first degree was history. So I think you can't erase it. You have to just explain it. So, but reconciliation. And that has been really the one bright part of my work on Kinder Morgan is the amount of work I've been able to do with First Nations folks. The Tsleil-Waututh, I've been working with them for 7 years on this, but able to go up through reserves and talk to folks along Pipeline Coldwater. And I think the best way to reconcile is to ask people what they'd like to have done. Is not to guess. Like, I kind of think the statue was kind of a guess of what people wanted done. I do think that it's best to ask the local nations what would be what is a plan we could put together to make this work, and then try to help the rest of the population explain, because we have a big immigrant population here who had no part in the kind of horrors that happened in the past. And so we have to explain to newcomers why we owe a debt to local nations. And so that's the best way forward. And I work with, federal parliamentarians that have, Romeo Saganash is a very good friend of mine, a residential school survivor. We communicate all the time. And I just see like the Indigenous language work that we've done in Parliament now, I was on the first committee where we actually had simultaneous translation with Cree and English and French. But that was requested by nations who wanted a voice in Parliament. So I think that's something we could do perhaps at City Hall, is that we could have council sessions where perhaps translation would be available. Often it's not on every session, but it's on particular sessions to try to help bring forward local languages. But only if that was something that a nation would like to have happen. I do think it always has to be grassroots when it comes to those policies.
Well, let's pivot into a closing section on more about you and more of the color, I guess, of you. Let's start with, what are some of the favorite hobbies, interests you have that aren't political? Like, do you do when it's the weekend and you have a weekend?
Put the politics outside.
Okay. I listen to a lot of music. Being a musician but not really playing anymore, that's listen to tons of music. I watched a movie last night, Chasing the Train, about John Coltrane, but I am a closet metal fan, so I like my Slayer. my brother is, like I said, my brother plays punk rock as well. So music is a huge thing. And also reading is kind of boring. I mean, what do my wife and I do? We read, we go for walks on the seawall, we stop for pints, not too many, but come home and then work on politics, do our writing. It's not, but I do think when I look at successful politicians, that's kind of how they run their lives. Like Jack Layton was a huge inspiration for me, and he was so dedicated to his politics. That's really all he did. He would come out for one beer and then he would just go back and do his work. And I think that's what it takes. It's so complicated in this society. It's so tough that you really have to do this all the time, or you just shouldn't do the job.
Vancouver has always had a vibrant music scene. What's your favorite band or musician to ever come out of Vancouver?
You can't say yourself.
Can I say my brother's band? Yeah. Yeah. Bishop's Green? Yeah, I have Bishop's to do that. Green? Yeah, Bishop's Green, right. Yeah.
And if you weren't to say your brother's band?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there'd be bands now that are gone. Like, I love Art Bergman. I just thought he is so much the scene here, and then so unrecognized, right? Just like the punk stuff that came through here, more current bands like Japan Droids, actually in the House of Commons, I used to do this thing where I would just slip the names of 10 local bands into my speeches. And then every once in a while, the speaker would look at me going, you know, I don't know.
Japan this bill is dead on arrival.
Exactly. So, I mean, I do think the more you can encourage local music, the better. And I'm trying to, what am I listening to? I just saw Jack White, and not local, but what an amazing show. That was just something else.
One of the other things that's come up recently is Justin McElroy for CBC ran this poll of Vancouver's unofficial ambassador.
Okay.
And if you didn't see it, Canuck the Crow won in the end. Would you have picked Canuck the Crow, or did you have a better choice for Vancouver's unofficial ambassador?
I don't know. These things, like, I am the kind of founder of Canadian e-petitions, but sometimes they can go a little sideways. So, you know, Bodie McBoatface, I think, was, and the Northwest Territories at one point, Bob. It was going to be called Bob, yeah. Right? So anyway, these things kind of have a life of their own. And the official ambassador for Vancouver.
I would have thought that the Crow would have been right at the top of your list because he lives right near the Burnaby, Vancouver. Yeah. I wonder if there's a good nexus there.
I've always liked Mike Harcourt. I think he's just a class act, and he has been for years, and understands the city, and always found kind of a middle way, whether it was on council or found a way to make things work. And so I just off the top of my head, I think he might be the person I would have voted for. But again, it's a younger population and all that, so I don't know if they would know that.
It's been 32 years since Expo 86, when Vancouver sort of came out to the world. A lot's changed in that time, and we've lost a lot. What venue, location, or thing has Vancouver lost that you miss the most?
The Town Pump. Yep. I might have played the Commodore 50 times, but I played the Town Pump over 100. And I just loved playing there.
And where was that?
That was down in Gastown, just by the Lamplighter. And it was grotty and dirty, but man, I saw, like, you know, Bo Diddley there, and Tragically Hip went through there, and it was the place because it was so accessible to everybody. And I don't really see as many venues like that now that you could have, like, on a Wednesday night, you could see five local bands play, you know, and I do miss that. I think music's moved on. It's a bit different now, but I do think live music, you can't beat it. And I'd like to see more of those come back, but bring back the Town Pump. They saved the Rio. So let's bring back the Town Pump.
What is your favorite park?
Yeah, my favorite park. I'm quite partial to Hastings Park. One of the first activist things I ever did was to try to organize something called the Hastings Park Festival, where I work with local folks based out of the community center there to try to make it more local. At that point, it was kind of a dust bowl, and the PNE came and
left. Hastings Park is the PNE grounds.
That's right. Yeah. But it was always supposed to be a park just like Stanley Park. It was supposed to, when it was deeded to the city, it was supposed to rival Stanley Park in its magnificence. And it's kind of like the East End, the East Side. It got passed over. So I do think I like it because I do think there's a brand new board there and there's some plans that could revitalize that park. But I really like, it might be an odd choice, but it's the potential of that park that I love the most.
Well, finally, the thing we end every episode of Can Be Report with is our Vancouverada, our random fact that people should know more about the city. You've lived here a number of years. What is your Vancouverada that you wish people were more aware of?
Well, one thing that springs to my mind is Malcolm Lowry, you know, wrote Under the Volcano here. And so we often don't think of Vancouver as a great place for literature, but a lot of good people have passed through here. And that Malcolm Lowry wrote that and refers to Vancouver in the book. He's not very kind to Vancouver, but but he perhaps captures the spirit of what happened here. Oh, and there's... But we are seeing, like, I love historical books about Vancouver, novels. There's one out, White Angel, and I'm sorry I've forgotten the author, but it captures Vancouver in the 1920s, before it actually incorporated into one big place. And just to imagine what the city was like then, I don't think we delve enough back into that, because it is a real clue to who we are now. You know, if you expose, say, for example, the racism in the book, in those early novel, The White Angels, you know, how many, you know, against the Chinese, essentially, you still see that in our culture now, right? So much blame for foreigners driving up our housing prices, and sometimes it's racism masked as an explanation for change. But if we just look back, lots of drug issues in those early novels and captured in the White Angel and in Lowry's book as well, like just a very heavy drinking. And I do think it's important to remember your past, and novels are a great way to do it.
I find that like looking back through Vancouver's history, and if you find like a bad policy decision, the reason for it is basically almost always racism.
Right. Yeah. Weird ones. They were going to abolish Chinatown and run a highway, you know, they were going to have another crossing. They actually had a plan, you can see in the archives, to put an island in the middle of False Creek where all the Chinese people would live. They actually had
literally put them on an island
in the middle of False Creek. It was a drafted plan, you can see in the city archives. Wow. And that's, you know, that's the 70s, right? So this struggle of who we are and coming to terms with, you know, if you look at early acts where China, it literally said Chinamen can't vote, like right up until 1935, it was this division and it still exists today. So it'd be really a good thing for us to move forward and try to, you know, try to understand ourselves, each other, a little better.
Well, this has been some wonkishness to rival like Sam Sullivan and Cum Tux. So thank you so much for sitting down with us. It has been, like, I know that I have learned a lot, and it's been really quite interesting. I've got some new books for my reading list.
Right.
Thank you. So where can people find you and your campaign?
KennedyStewart.ca is the website where everything it lives. But our new offices, our campaign offices on Main and 12th, are right in the corner there. And you'll see me out and about a lot at transit stations and, of course, Davy Street after 10 o'clock. That's the time to campaign there. So, and I really, you know, whatever party people are or independent people are supporting, I really just hope they get involved. I think, you know, 40% turnout rates are not great. So if we could drive that up a bit, and maybe we can. So I just think what I always say to people who don't know a lot about politics is the best thing you can do is go off and volunteer just for a day. Go door knocking, go stand and wave some signs, whatever. And I think the more engaged we are in democracy, the better. So I would really hope that people do that.
Well, you certainly seem like you're putting the NDP back into independent.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you again for sitting down with us. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
I'm Patrick Meehan.
This has been another episode of the Canby Report's ongoing mayoral interview series. Thank you so much for listening. Good night.